an interview with Louise Vasbari, professor of comparative literature, September 14, 1989, in her office in the library.
I was not in on that world that they were privileged to be in.
Well, now, suppose we go through those questions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, name, department, rank, and position.
Yes.
Louise Olga Vasvari. My present department is comparative literature. I also have a joint appointment with linguistics.
What linguistics?
Mm-hmm. I'm a full professor. However, when I came to Stony Brook, which is question number two, January 1973, and I was 29 years old. At that time, I came to the Spanish department as an assistant professor in Spanish.
I see.
And was there, I got tenure there and became associate professor there, and then I went to Conflict and became chair there and was kind of between the two places. And eventually, after I came back from working for Homer, my whole line, the budget line, was moved to Conflict. So now my title reads Professor of Comparative Literature and Linguistics, but my budget line is in Conflict.
All right. Where did you come from?
I had not had a full-time position before coming here. I got my PhD in the University of California at Berkeley in 1969, and between 1969 and when I came here in January 70, I lived in Europe with my husband, who was at CERN, a physicist, and so I was not gainfully employed then. It was very difficult to do so in Europe. Who was primarily responsible for my coming to Stony Brook? It was, funnily enough, an institution I myself had been interested in. It wasn't a particular person who recruited me originally. It was also a practical place to come because my husband and I were looking both for jobs at that time, and Brookhaven was a place that he might work and the New York area. So in part it was the New York area and the proximity of Brookhaven. In part I wanted to come to New York, coming back from Europe, and I wanted to work at a public university. And all of those things fit, and I had a few interviews. I was living in Europe at the time, and I came back to America and had a few interviews. And then when I got to Stony Brook, I didn't know the people who were here at that time, but they knew some of my mentors and so forth. So it was not through any kind of personal contact in any way at that time.
I see.
Who interviewed me for the position here? The prime person was the chairman at that time. Well, it was two people. One was Iris, spelled as Iris, I-A-R-S. Iris Zavala, who was a senior woman professor in Spanish at that time. And the other person was the then chair, whose name I'm having a mental block on. Will come back to me.
Because
McKenna was no longer in the... He was no longer than what had happened. More interesting, the name will come back to me. I'm having a block thinking of Elias Rivers, who was the later chair. But the situation at that time was that originally there had been a Romance Languages department here, and none of them had a graduate program. And in the Romance Languages, which included French, Italian, and Spanish language teaching and some undergraduate courses, the French sort of had the upper hand. This was before I arrived. And at a certain moment, about a year before I came, so it was must have started planning in the early 70s, a Spanish PhD program came to be planned. And an outside chairman was brought in, and the Spanish component of the Romance Languages was split off. He came in to head that. They started the graduate program, got library money, recruiting money, and all sorts of... That's what I'm having, this ridiculous mental block.
Is he still here?
No. He left and has been to many other jobs, and he and I didn't get along a lot, which is why I think it's a Freudian mental block.
I see.
He'll come back. So he was recruited as the new chair. He brought some people with him. He had been at Washington University in St. Louis is where he came from. And he brought then an assistant professor named Bill Little with him, who had been a student. He brought Pedro Lastra, who is still here, who was a professor there. Then they were joined by Jaime Giordano, who's still here, who was already previously here in the Romance Languages department. And then they formed that way the nucleus of the beginning department, and then they started recruiting other people. And I was probably the first person that was recruited that either wasn't coming from here internally or that who were not brought from St. Louis. And I was hired to do historical linguistics and medieval literature. Yes, Edie Sawala was here already, too. That's the other person. She already had been here previously. And that started the split between the Romance languages and a kind of animosities between them, because suddenly Spanish, which had been the sort of the poor brother, suddenly went ahead and started having the PhD program, and as you probably know, French and Italian don't have one today, and probably will not, because, as you know, things have changed. And so since they missed the boat in the early 70s, that is the history of that.
Well, now let's see, Lynette Brugmans was French.
She was French, that's right.
And Conrad Bieber?
Was French.
Was French.
And he was one of the former chairs of that larger unit, yes. And Sandy Petrie was already here at that time. Mario Mignone was here. A lot of the people, yes, that's actually interesting, a lot of the people who you might know by name in French and Italian now, very many of them were here at that time, that is previous to me. Someone like Bieber or Zimmerman were already quite senior then. Sandy Petrie, I remember, when I arrived in 73, said to me, and I met him the first year, and he said, I've been here 7 years, and at that time I thought, my God, this is a lifetime, you know. And so he came in, mid-60s, and he had just been promoted at that time, just had gotten tenure or whatever. So the funny thing is, those people in French and Italian have had relatively little mobility. So many of those people I knew then, who then were very senior to me, or like Sandy, were just a little bit senior, were already here and haven't left. In Spanish, of those people who were here previous to me, only Jaime Giordano, who had been here, and Pedro Lastra, who came in with the new chairman, new at that time, the year before I did, or semester before I did, they are still here. Everybody else, and I think I'm not wrong in that, who is in the Spanish department now, I am senior to. So in other words, the history of the Spanish department has been tremendously different from that first moment of impetus when they had the PhD program, that they've had a much greater turnover. The people have had much more mobility, put it this way. And plus they have grown. That's the other aspect too. So both in growth and in turnover.
McKenna went over into administration.
McKenna had gone over into administration slightly before my arrival. So in fact, when I first came here, I didn't meet him for about a semester or so. He was not in any way involved in Spanish. He was not teaching or anything else. He later came back and taught some courses, but for several years at that time when he was working for Gelder, he was in absolute no day-to-day involvement with Spanish. And I think he had done that a year or two before, just about the time that this split was taking place. I think then he saw his opportunity in administration and so forth.
Are you Spanish yourself?
No, I'm Hungarian.
You're Hungarian?
Actual Hungarian, not hyphenated American. I'm born in Hungary.
I see. Budapest.
Yes. However, the majority of people who have been in the Spanish department have been Hispanic, Spanish-speaking. Yes, the great majority of them have been. So the department had always been run in Spanish, and all meetings in Spanish, and the great majority of graduate students had been. So it's a very much Spanish-oriented. Spanish was my second language before English, my second culture. After being a refugee from Hungary, I went to South America. I was second place, but I'm not born Spanish. Culturally, I don't consider myself Spanish, but I'm a more or less native speaker capacity. Okay, should I continue? Or?
Yes, go ahead.
Why did I come, and what factors are more important? My decision, as I said, one was the geographical area, placement for my husband and myself. I really wanted to be in a public university. I had graduated from Berkeley, and I had a kind of reverse snobbery about public universities as against privates. Also having come from Hungary, where the situation is quite different in that. And I was a real believer at that time. I'm probably somewhat disillusioned since then, but at that time I was a great believer.
Well, most of us who are in the public system were educated in the private system.
Yes.
I was Wesleyan and then Harvard. And my life until I joined the New York State system was in the private system. All right, go ahead with it.
And those were the factors. Plus, I liked Well, the only actual opportunity I had at that time was a job at Princeton, but that was on a lecturer level, a kind of postdoc. So this was a better job as far as being assistant professor. That was a more prestigious place. But I wanted to come here for all these factors. And also, it was an opportunity in the sense that what I was hired for, I was the only person in that field. So there were a lot of disadvantages, but the great advantage was that I knew that I could be doing advanced courses and other things, and I had graduate students from the beginning because there was no one else in that field, so I didn't, so that was...
And your field is what?
At that time I was working, well, my PhD is actually in Romance philology, which is historical linguistics of the Romance languages in Latin and medieval literature of the major Romance languages. So I was teaching medieval Spanish, and I was teaching historical linguistics at that time, and then I also, we started a master's program in bilingualism, and I was doing synchronic linguistics, contrastive analysis of English and Spanish phonology and syntax and various other things at that time. Now I do much more. My work has always been comparative because I was not just in Spanish but in the Romance languages. My work now is much more broadly comparative, but that's what I was teaching at that time. Give my impression of Stony Brook when I came, the campus, the people, the leadership, the spirit. Now the questions become a little bit more difficult. Well, for me personally, as far as the campus and the environment, was a shock because I had come from Switzerland. Before that, I had lived in Berkeley. And I'm a European and a city person. And it didn't resemble any of those places. I wasn't thinking I was going to find Berkeley, but I was hoping to find a university community, and I guess what the shock was at that time, to answer to the campus and the people, and I still find that I find a tremendous lack of university community, and the kind of what we could call a town-gown conflict, and the whole geographic setup of the place that does not lend itself to have the campus go right into the community in any way and have bookstores and restaurants and whatever.
Because this isn't Cambridge or Ann Arbor or New Haven or Princeton.
So that was my problem at the time with it, and I think that continues to be.
Well, this was country out here.
Yeah. Well, by the time I got here, it wasn't quite country. It was obviously much less development than now. It wasn't quite country. It was not quite yet suburb, but... Well, it always seemed to me that the whole construction of this campus started from a very strange premise. That is, if you have a piece of land like this, if you take Berkeley, the campus I know best, the administration building, student union, and so forth are on one border of the campus, which leads out to a street.
Yes,
which is, okay, it's university, but the equivalent in any other campus, whatever you call it, a kind of main street, which then caters directly to people walking off that campus in restaurants, bookstores, all sorts of things. If you build a campus that's on a piece of land like this and you decide that the center of the campus is going to be right in the middle, not at any of the potential crossroads that touch around the town or anything else, then of course to get to anywhere you're going to have this tremendous amount of space. So there's, just on the basis of that, physically, as far as physical planning, it's not going to work. And to tell you frankly, I've lost faith. I lived here from 1973 till 6 years ago. I was here all the time. I was very active, first in various committees of the Senate, and I was an officer in the Senate. I ended up, as I told you, working for Homer and so forth. But that never changed. There never came to be a community. At a certain point, I gave up on that as far as my ability to develop a personal life. So now I live in New York. And that has many disadvantages, but after whatever, almost 15 years of it.
Yeah, all right. This let's stay with that for a minute. How does one change the situation here so that the faculty develop a personal life? Now, are you and your husband separated?
No, I'm married again. I have a second husband who works at this campus.
Works here. I see. But you live in New York.
Both live in New York.
Both live in New York. Uh-huh. What was missing out here?
Okay, for me personally, I'm a city person in any case, so probably in fairness I have to say that I'm not much for country or suburban living, and all the advantage you might have of a very large house and three-car garage and swimming pool are not my primary interests and values, okay? That aside, so I may be somewhat more prejudiced against that than someone else. But even that aside, I think what was missing is partly what I just said from the very conception of just how the campus was built. It's going to be very, just physically speaking, you know, if we're right here, and we say, oh, let's continue this informally. Lunch is starting. We're getting hungry. Let's go somewhere. We could just, if we were in Berkeley or Ann Arbor or whatever, which, okay, let's just walk down. We'll talk while we're walking, and we'll go there and find some place to sit down and whatever. Right? This becomes, in this campus, physically an impossibility. There is nowhere to go on campus. Now they've reopened. Look at the faculty club situation. I remember when they had the faculty club years ago, when they restarted it, and my number was 34, I remember, because I joined it as soon as I got the thing saying, oh, finally something is going to happen. Now, even that was a very partial thing. You know, there was no kitchen there. You couldn't go there in the evening or the afternoon, in the morning, only within limited hours. But for a while, a lot of people, and myself included, I went religiously trying to support it, thinking this was a place that you could meet other people from other departments. And indeed, I have memories of meeting a few people who otherwise I never would have met. And
it's back.
And then it folded, yes. But then it folded. I mean, yes. So I had been here, whatever, 5 years, 6 years before it started. Yeah. It continued for, whatever, 3 years or something, I don't remember exactly. And then it folded again for 5 years. Now they're trying, and that's very nice. But again, yesterday I wanted to meet with someone at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I had to make a terrible tea in my hot office to talk to her, because there was nowhere I could say, okay, it's 4:15, let's just walk down. We're going to go to the student union in the dirt there with the plastic and the styrofoam and the dirt all over the place. So there's simply, to this day, nowhere you could go at 4 in the afternoon to have a cup of coffee in a decent surrounding. So even if you meet somebody that you already know, you can't go off with them, much less go there. And supposedly, this is a new faculty member I was having coffee with in our department. The ideal would be, not only could I go there with her, but there we may meet somebody else she doesn't know, and I could say, meet our new faculty member, and so forth and so on. And this simply has never existed. And I think that's the first step, on campus. So the first, there are two things, on campus and off campus. So the first step would be on campus, even if we can't walk off campus, to have some place that really is for faculty and staff, not for students, not for all of these other things, and that is decent and clean and has some services, and that you can count on being there, and you meet other people there. And the other would be to have some sort of relationship with, I mean, the idea that if I walk over there towards, we still have a house here, so I stay here sometimes on Hollow Road. If you walk over to that direction by the railroad station, you can't get a cup of coffee there. The one diner that was there burned down. What have they put in there? A ritzy children's clothing store. And next to it is a real estate agent. And across the street is a bank. This is, I mean, that represents to me the tremendous mismatch between the campus and the rest of the town. Not only does it take 20 minutes through the mud to walk to the edge of campus, but when I get there, I can go to a ritzy children's store, but there's nowhere I could have a cup of coffee if I want to get on the train. For those of us who commute.
What about the park bench?
Well, park bench is a little bit far off as far as just going to the, if you're going by the railroad station, it's a little bit further over. Yes, that's one place that people go at lunchtime. But even then, okay, you want to go to the front park bench. Okay, let's say that certainly is physically the closest place one could go to have lunch, let's say, without getting into the car. Have you tried walking over there? Across the fields when it rains, sloshing through the mud? Is there any plan in this university, now that they're building all that stuff, to make a walkway that you don't go through the railroad tracks and the mud? If I come in on the train from New York, I have to wear special shoes so that I can make it to my office from the train. I guess those may seem petty things, but I think you have to start with that. If there is, even to get to the park bench, you can't get there. Even if you're willing to walk 15 minutes, is...
Have you met the new provost?
No, I have not, because I've been away all last year.
Well, he ought to hear this.
I mean, nobody seems to think about this.
I think he is. And I think some people are thinking about it, have been thinking about it. I think you're absolutely right.
That's very simple, a path. Something like a path would be a very simple gesture.
Yeah. All right, let's...
Or the bus service, have it be organized in a way that it functions better so you can get around from one place to another. Okay, continue.
Let's go back and follow the questions.
The campus, the people, the leadership, the spirit at that time. Okay, when I came, we're back to number 8. My main thing about the leadership and the spirit was that I came just at the end. I remember the first Senate meeting that I went to was still before it was a representational Senate. So in principle, everybody, every faculty member was a member of the Senate. And I think that was the last semester. However, I can understand that it didn't matter because about the number of people showed up at that meeting, as later when they restructured it and then had officially a representative from each department plus elected certain number of people, so the whole body was not larger, so I can understand, which signifies to me at that time that there was something lacking in that general spirit. Well, yes, indeed, I remember that that first semester, January 73, that I came in, and I started getting all these mailers about Senate meeting, this and that. And being a young person and not knowing what was expected, I went to another colleague in the department and said, well, look here, they said this meeting is on Monday, you know. Am I supposed to go? Do you go? Whatever. And he, like, almost didn't understand the question. Like, oh, well, you know, I never bother with that. I just, you know. And so I went. And I remember the first person I met was Max Dresden. And he tried to throw me out of the meeting. Because, as I said, I was 29 years old, so he made the sexist assumption that I was a student being young and female. And so my first encounter with the Senate was not too happy. But then I sat through that and went to those meetings and they were not well attended. And then very soon after, somehow, I guess what happened then when I became a representational Senate, I became the representative for my department. So that was the step that I started getting into the
room.
Who were
the meetings?
Max Dresden was the head at that time.
Of the Senate?
Of the Senate, yes. Then when it became representational, I don't remember who the very first person was, but soon thereafter, how I got involved in university-wide experience is that then I must have volunteered to be the representative for my department. And that was an interesting experience because it was about as boring as Senate meetings can be. I did find that to be the one place where there wasn't a place to have a cup of coffee, but where people came together from different departments. So I kind of found it interesting. But it meant that, to me, it was a place that you had to go out of your way to do something like that to begin to know what's going on. Because I think that was really my going to the Senate, my taking that seriously at the beginning. Probably, I had never reflected on this, but that's probably, now that I'm talking about it, what led to all the other things I eventually did in administration. Because by going there, and I continue to go because, as I said, I found there what I was looking for elsewhere and didn't find. So I began to know people, which of course later I realized were always the same people, still the same people who were active then, but I didn't know that then. Okay, so I met Irving Cron, Norm Goodman, and Joe Rosenthal, and the usual cast of characters. And I remember it was Norm Goodman, who, being a woman, I have to tell you that I have to be somewhat sensitive to who were the people who maybe gave me a helping hand and who were very much the opposite. And as I said, the very negative one was Max Dresden from the very beginning, who was the prototype of sexist male. And just the opposite example was Norm Goodman, who one day called me up and said, and I was an assistant professor at the time, and said, how would you like to run for Secretary of Senate? Because since I was a member of the Senate, people they would put up would have to be from people who were already members. And I said, I don't know why, and I don't know enough people, and how would I do this, and so forth. And he very patiently talked me into it. Now, of course, I didn't know at the time. It's hard to get candidates, so he was only doing his job. But that's really, it was Norm Goodman who started me off being involved, and then I became vice president. That was the Arts and Sciences Senate, not the University Senate, when they made this distinction that has never worked quite well, because you never knew which one you were at, because one was only slightly bigger than the other. And so then I got quite involved in the Senate. And because I was going to these meetings, then I soon began to realize, even though I was only an assistant professor, because all the people in my department weren't going to anything, and because the majority of them, as I told you, were Hispanic, so they were sort of not in tune with how an American university system works anyway, there was a culture clash, I, without realizing it, became the person in the department who got to know those kind of bureaucratic answers and became the liaison with all sorts of things. So I started doing various jobs in the department, being undergraduate director and being on various committees, and started serving on a number of university-wide committees. And that indirectly is what then eventually led me in 1980, I guess, when Homer came in, for him to ask me to work with him as a social provost. But it all started with Norm Goodman in the Senate.
I see.
But that was the people and the leadership. It would be that, I guess, my answer to put that in shorter form, number eight, would be that I found the Senate to the place where I could find something going on. After doing it for a number of years, it gave me a lot of information. It made me understand the university. It made me see who the people were. And that I think, was the only vehicle. There was no other vehicle, a social vehicle or some such, to do that. But that, too, I began to realize with time that was only a handful of people who were doing that. Most of them were these people who had been here in the 60s already, and who are continuing to do that, and there's no new blood in that kind of leadership. And I mean the faculty leadership now, not the higher administration.
So when you came in 73, John Toll was still here.
Yes,
and
he was.
Alec Pond was executive.
Mm-hmm.
VP.
I had no contact with him.
And the dean? Was Weisinger still here?
Weisinger was here. Kalish was around when I first came.
Okay. Was Sidney Gilbert a dean then, or was he chairman of philosophy?
No, he was already, I believe, in his position.
I see. Okay.
But in the early years, I had no contact with any of those people except Kalish.
What was he doing? He was chairman of what?
He had a university-wide administrative position.
Was he dean of the social sciences?
No, I mean he had been dean, but that was not my contact with him, because I remember having to go to him at one time, and as dean of social sciences at that time, I would have had no reason to go to him. I think it was that strange position that was then bantied back and forth, was eliminated, which Helin later held, which was kind of like a dean of arts and sciences type of thing. I think, whatever the exact name was, but it was something of that sort. The position that we don't have it now.
Right.
And that Helin was the last one who had it when we had that system that we had the so-called provost deans, who are not called divisional deans, but were first called provosts. And we had the divisional deans, and we had Helin over them, and that didn't work out, and then he resigned. So I think Kalish was the previous person in the job. Helin came much later. By that time, I was quite active. But the higher echelons of the administrators, I had no contact whatever at that time. So I would have had no particular opinion about them personally.
Okay.
Just a general opinion, which is that everyone in humanities always felt at that time that Toll was a physicist, was interested in physics, was interested in developing physics, especially the good science departments, but even the bad science departments. And they were getting everything, and the humanities was shunted and always got the worst of everything. And that was certainly always the perception of people in humanities. That hasn't totally changed, but I would say it has changed a little bit.
We're a historian now as a provost.
Well, but I mean, that's brand new. There's no perception of him yet at all.
Right.
But I mean, even with a Marburger and Homer having been physicists, I think the perception changed somewhat. It didn't turn around, but it changed somewhat. But that was probably, if I had to say, what was the perception or the spirit of the people in humanities, almost to 100%, was that they felt disenfranchised from the whole thing. It was somewhat less of a problem in Spanish because, as I said, in the early 70s, they were getting funding and so forth to build this PhD program. But still, that was the general...
When did Stan Ross leave? you know?
That was before my time. No. I never knew him. So it must have been about 1970 or something like that.
All right.
I never knew him, just by name.
Next question.
Number 9, what events, persons, experience stand out from that early time? Is that what you mean here, or just overall over the years? From that early time, it was basically when I came in, the people who stood out at that time are those same people I've mentioned who are still the ones who you always see and hear and who are the heads of the Senate and the committees. They haven't changed. I guess a few younger people have been at it, but for the most part, most of them are the same. The events were what I said, that my perception when I came in, that it was a very different university from what it had been in the 60s, when people like Sandy Petrie or Jim McKenna started telling me how it was when they came in the mid-60s, and Jim McKenna once told me that they hired 100 assistant professors the year he came in, and that they sent a chauffeured limousine to pick him up at the airport as an assistant professor, right? And by the time they recruited me in 72, and I came in 73 because I got the job a whole year earlier, I was treated fine, but I mean, that was absolutely nothing like that, and I was one of the few who was coming in. So I had this feeling that it all had already happened and all that boom had finished. It still looked like a mining town, I mean, the building in that sense, but that there were all these people who were here before, and there is definitely that division. And that exists to this day, because even though now I count as a senior person that